Hello everyone, I'm David. I'm a technical architect at the Government Digital Service. About 2 years ago, I was sat in the room downstairs listening to Tom Loosemore talk about the Government Digital Service and GDS and what we were doing and how we were doing it. Gov.uk was about 8 months old, and we just started spending time with other government departments helping them to build new digital services. I had been sent off down to sunny Swansea, famous for its beaches and the Mumbles Mile, and also made famous by Yes Minister for the DVLA. For anyone who doesn't know the DVLA and what the DVLA does, it's the Driving Vehicle Licensing Agency. It's responsible for pretty much anything to do with driving a vehicle or owning a vehicle in the UK. They look after four different things, the first of which is driving licences. There's about 10 million of these issued every year. It's a plastic card that tells you whether or not you can drive particular vehicles. If you're learning to drive, you'll have a green one. If you've passed your test, you've got a pink one. And until earlier this week, we also issued a piece of paper with it, which contained penalty points and disqualifications and stuff like that. DVLA also deal with car tax, otherwise known as vehicle excise duty. Until October last year, when you paid your vehicle tax, you used to get a piece of paper. You had to carefully tear this circular thing out of the holder it came in and put it in your window. There's about 50 million transactions of those every year. Brings in about £6 billion to the Treasury, which is then spent on wider public services. Third thing they deal with is V5C registration certificates. These are little booklets which come with every vehicle. They contain information about the vehicle, what the engine size is, CO2 emissions, what colour the vehicle is. And any time you want to make a change to that vehicle, say you want to change the address or you want to sell the vehicle to someone else, you have to write on that document and send it to DVLA, and DVLA will process it and send a new one to either you or the person you sold the vehicle to. Again, it's about 50 million of those every year. And the final thing they deal with is number plates. You can buy a personalised number plate and put it on a car, and you can transfer, if you buy a new car, you can transfer that number plate from one car to the other. There's about 1.8 million transfers and of number plates every year, costs about 6.5 million. And this one is entirely paper-based at the moment. There's no digital transaction. It's all paper. You're going to send it to the DVLA. DVLA will process it and send you a bunch of paper back. So four different things, and they're all very, very heavily paper-based. So much so that this building here, this is D Block at DVLA in Swansea, it is mostly there for processing paper. A lorry arrives every day full of paper. It gets opened, the mail gets opened, it gets scanned, it gets digitised, and then the transaction gets processed. So much paper arrives at this building, but this building doesn't just have one postcode, or two, or three. It has an entire postcode region attached to it. If you ever send a letter to DVLA, you need to make sure you've got the right postcode, because otherwise the letter might end up in the wrong place. So there's a long list of possible postcodes you could send messages, send your letters to or your forms to. Make sure you find the right one. DVLA isn't entirely paper-based. They have spent a lot of time over the last 10 years putting services online. This was the DirectGov tax disc service that was launched in 2001, and about 50% of people were taxing their cars online, but still led to paper being sent out, even if it wasn't paper coming in. DVLA's technology has been built up over the last 25 years. This is a diagram of DVLA's simplified architecture. It's built over 25 years. There's a mainframe hidden away in there somewhere. There's a bunch of Oracle databases, various custom-built applications which no one knows how they work anymore. It's slow to change. It's difficult to change. You can make a change in one bit and it'll have a completely unintended consequence somewhere else. It's difficult to test. We can only make changes to it a couple of times a year. It's not a simple process. So when we started down there 2 years ago, we wanted to try and make changes quickly and build new things, but at the same time we wanted to try and avoid messing with some of the legacy stuff, because that way leads madness and pain. So we started off with something really simple. We went right back to basics. And we started to build, we chose to build a read-only service, something that wouldn't work with the legacy system, just take a copy of the data and display, provide a new service to the public. We started off with new technology. We used MongoDB instead of the mainframe. We used Linux instead of AIX and the mainframe. We used cloud-based servers with automated deployment environments, as opposed to physical TIN within a data center, and things like continuous integration and deployment, so that we could keep making changes quickly and iteratively. We started getting the team to work in sprints and in co-located locations. So you had designers, developers, user researchers, the product owner, the delivery manager, all sat together in one space so they could work on building this new service together. And sprints, we had walls with put with cards on them, and as stories got completed, the cards moved from one column to another, and then daily stand-ups to help talk through what everyone was working on. It doesn't sound particularly revolutionary, but this is something that hadn't been done before in a massive waterfall organisation with lots of big projects that deliver in Big Bang at the end. We also did things like open show and tells. So this is the A Block Atrium in DVLA. It's a big open space in the middle of a campus. We did all of our show and tells every 2 weeks in this open space, so that people walking past would see what was going on and maybe stop and look and contribute to the show and tell. And it helped people kind of understand what was going on and feel like they were getting involved in what we were building. We also built prototypes. We built prototypes quickly, put them in front of users and tested them, saw how people reacted to using them, and then iteratively improved the service afterwards. And the other thing, doesn't seem like much, but we started giving people stickers. As they were working on projects, we produced a sticker to set that they could put on a laptop or a notebook or a lanyard and say, "I worked on that thing." No matter who you work for, whether you're DVLA's legacy supplier, whether you were a DVLA member staff, whether you were a contractor or a permanent member staff, we gave them stickers. And something they could hold up and say, "I worked on that thing, I worked on that project," and they had some ownership into that piece of technology that they'd built and that service they'd built. So after spending a couple of months working on the service, we launched the first version, View Driving License. Simple thing. Lets you go online and view information about your driving license, your penalty points, disqualifications, what vehicles you can drive, the status of your license, that kind of stuff. I'd say none of this was particularly revolutionary. It was the way you kind of expect it to happen in a startup or a modern organisation, but this was fundamentally new and a different way of doing things. For our second project, we wanted to do something a bit more complicated. And for some reason, we chose DVLA's biggest service, Cartax. We found a development team hidden away that was busy working on other things and got them involved in the project. And we spent 12 weeks, we built a brand new Cartax service for DVLA. It was integrated with a legacy estate, but it meant that we could make changes to what the public saw on a much more frequent basis. We can make changes to this service daily instead of having to do it monthly or even quarterly or six-monthly. So we could see how people were working with it, were using the service, and then iteratively improve it. People, as we started to do all this, people got excited. They liked this new way of working. They wanted to do more of it. So we started doing things like holding hack days. We've held a couple of these now. The idea behind them, no matter who you work for, if you're on DVLA site, you can come along, get involved, and help us build some prototype services. We also brought up some students from a local university who got involved as well. And a really good thing about this particular day is that at least two of the prototypes that were built are now being turned into proper, real public services that will be available to the public in the future. So that thing has actually come up with something that's going to be available to the members of the public. DVLA is quite lucky in Swansea. There's two big universities. There's Swansea University and University of Wales Trinity St David. bit of a mouthful, but we've been working with them to train up staff so that all of our staff can learn how to code, they can learn how technology works, and also so that we can bring in new graduates into DVLA, so new designers, new project managers, new software engineers, and bring them into DVLA so DVLA can start upskilling and building some of these things themselves. And the other thing is we hooked up with Tech Hub in Swansea, which is a building full of small tech companies building interesting products. We partly sponsored the building, and also DVLA has a presence there as well, which means we're starting to build products alongside these companies and learning from them and picking up how they work and bringing that into DVLA's environment. All of this, say, not particularly revolutionary, but what it did is it let people think differently about how they were going to work. One of DVLA's developers, after being involved in some of these projects, walked away and said, I'm really interested in this and I want to talk to other people who are doing it. So he went away and set up the Swansea Software Development Community, which is a monthly meetup in Swansea to talk about software engineering and products, projects they're working on, and help share knowledge. This is something that didn't exist before, and he set it up on his own back, and it's now there. It's been running for over a year now in Swansea, and there'll also be he's organising a big conference in Swansea at the end of the year. So the whole purpose of a bunch of this was to kind of get DVLA to be able to build their own services, and since then they've built a whole load more things. So if you have a fleet company, you've got potentially hundreds of thousands of vehicles, you have to deal with hundreds of thousands of those V5 documents. They are that's a nightmare to look after, so there's a new service they can use at the moment to manage their vehicles online. That means hundreds of thousands of V5 documents aren't being sent to Swansea. Tell DVLA you sold a car to a Motor Trader. That's another bit on that V5 booklet, which no longer needs to be sent to DVLA because we have a public beta that's live. Take a number plate off a car, put a number plate on a car. At the beginning, I said that these were entirely paper-based transactions. These launched just over a month ago, these public betas, and one of them has at least 33% digital take-up already. So that's 33% less paper turning up at DVLA's office in Swansea. Massive amount of time saved as well. Paper used to take two to six weeks to be dealt with. Now it happens within minutes on the digital service. And of course, that means more stickers for everyone, which is a big positive. This is a picture from Sarah, one of DVLA's testers, and she worked on a whole bunch of projects and started to build up a big sticker collection of things she's worked on. DVLA's blogging about what they're doing, the code on GitHub. If there's got any questions, I will answer them.
So you said there was stuff they're bringing in, students or something. What accessibility is there for, well, people not within the government for the data of this? Or is this all just your individual stuff?
Yeah, so there is a bunch of data that DVLA has. DVLA are looking at how they can open up some of that data. It's not a simple process. We spent some time working on improving their software skills, and now we're looking at other things we can work with them on as well.
So that's lots of paper not being sent and processed through DVLA,
yep.
which is good, obviously. does that mean lots of staff being made redundant because there's no paper to process?
Hopefully not. That's one of the reasons why we're teaming up with the universities. So we've got two universities. We're working with the universities to help retrain people and skill people up in new technologies. And also, actually, once we start reducing down some of the paper, we can redirect people to areas where they're more needed. There's huge amounts of casework that we're never going to get rid of. So complicated things that you're dealing with. For example, if you have a medical condition, you might need an assessment and various other things before you can have your license returned to you. We can start directing some of the people that were doing the mundane task of digitising paper to handling some of those transactions, which hopefully makes things better for everyone.
How do you engage with the less technically adept or comfortable members of the community around? My parents are both quite comfortable with technology. I know a number of people in their generation who are uncomfortable, frankly terrified of the internet or
yep.
and I love these sort of services. It's how I want to run my life. They want to have bits of paper.
Yep. I think it's fair to say DVLA aren't getting rid of the paper anytime soon. Our aim is to try and move more people to using the online service, because that'll mean we can direct people else. We can direct resources and people and money elsewhere. But the paper things are going to stick around. We're also looking at how we can provide assisted digital options so that we can help people get more confident in using technology. DVLA hold some regular events in Swansea. Because they're Swansea-based, they're holding regular events in Swansea to help train people into using computers and helping them get more confident in using technology. So there's a bunch of different events that happen, and DVLA are working with the Western government on making digital transactions.
I don't know the car, so I'm not sure if it's true, but is it that car tax discs are no longer actually paper at all?
Yes, so that's one of the things we did in October. So we know, if I drop back to here... We no longer issue these. In October, we stopped sending those out. There's been no need for them for quite a while, so we don't send them out. They're not valid anymore. So if you see cars with them on, they don't mean anything. We already have a database full of the cars that have taxed and the cars that haven't taxed, and that we use that instead.
Okay, so thanks, Dan, cool. And hand over to Matt.
Okay, mine's considerably less serious sometimes, just to warn you all in advance. But there is some stuff that crosses over quite a bit. So anyway, my name's Dukeson, I'm Matt Dukes. I'm going to take you on a little bit of a time travel. So I'm going to start in about the same time as I started today's talk, just about 2 years ago. I was at Open Tech 2 years ago as well. But just a couple of weeks after that, I woke up on a Saturday morning. I was a little bit hungover, as is my wont. I was kind of a bit foggy-eyed. It wasn't that early in the day. As I tend to do, I checked my Twitter stream before I'd even really got up, which I know is sad. And I looked down, and it appeared that I had an awful lot of mentions, and I don't really get that many, usually. So I kind of assumed I'd just been drunk and tweeted something ridiculous the night before. But I put my glasses on and I started to kind of set through them a little bit. But then I realised actually that wasn't the case and it was something quite different. And what had happened is this chap, who is a guy called Tim Harford, who I'm sure some of you have heard of, is a best-selling author. He wrote a book called The Undercover Economist. He's the presenter for More or Less on Radio 4. And as it turns out, has got a Saturday morning Financial Times column. So he'd spent a good 800,000 words of his column completely berating a certain website about how terrible it was, how useless, how impossible to use. He made a statement that using the internal search was like Google on LSD. And basically finished that piece by saying that the website was a national embarrassment. Now, the website he was talking about was Office for National Statistics. At that point, I'd been their new head of digital for 2 weeks. And all those mentions were people asking me what the F I was going to do about it. So I reconsidered my life and thought maybe I should have gone staying at Tesco's, stacking shelves. But I had a mortgage, so there was no real escape, so I had to think of something else. So we moved forward again. So we're travelling a bit better this time, so we're travelling 6 months forward. And this is 6 months where I get to know the organisation. So all those things that Di was just talking about how bad DVLA is, we make DVLA look like Google, essentially. But if you knew how the statistics that run this country were created, you'd be terrified. or the technology, fundamentally. But we had this whole thing. So what I was learning was the reason that the website was so bad was that it wasn't just the front end. Every single step behind it was equally complicated. The organization was lucky to get 2 or 3 deployments of new code out a year. That was kind of the best that they've ever achieved, was 3 deployments in a single year. So we were pinning a lot of hopes on just a couple of deployments to make these improvements. We were under a lot of pressure. Tim Harford wasn't alone in being a kind of media critic of the site. Basically, anyone who used the site was kind of was taking a pop at that point. There was even a parliamentary investigation into how bad the website was. I had to be through that before. So it's kind of bad, but we're 6 months in. So we spent a lot of time working on this. We have some stuff. So we have improvements to the navigation and we have improvements to the search. So I was sat at Dove Camp. It's the one that was at the Mayor's Place in London, City Hall. I'm sure a few of you might have been there. Jenny, who sat here somewhere, I think, still stitched me up to do a talk about ONS and about stats on the web. And while we were doing that talk, I got a text message to say the deployment had been a success. So I was thinking, this is a good day. I've had a few beers, I'm having a chat with my friends at GovCamp, and I can finally say we're going to be able to make some improvements. It didn't go well at all. So by lunchtime on the Monday, the performance of the site had degraded to such a point that we couldn't keep up with it. So our ops team were basically just trying to do anything they could just to keep the site up. By Tuesday, they admitted that they didn't have any idea what was causing it. Wednesday, we just about got GDP figures out before the site ground almost entirely to a halt. So everyone's in full-on panic mode at this point. On the Friday, we were releasing zero-hour stats for the first time. So anyone you know about the kind of the whole political stuff about zero-hour contracts? It was the first time ONS really ever even admitting they existed. It was slightly politically hot potatoed, and we had a website that was essentially dying on its ass. So our ops team said on the Thursday that the best case actually was to class it, we'll turn it on and turn it off again. So that was going to be our big answer to it. Unfortunately, the site went down for 11 hours. Completely down, dead, died, nothing to do about it. So we kind of, you know, everyone's just shouting at each other basically. We did, however, just about get the site back up in time for the 0 hour stuff the next day. But as you can imagine, there were a lot of repercussions. So again, forward 6 months. In those 6 months, we do a piece of work with ODI, with Jenny and her team, which was really helpful and influential, but mainly pointed out just how little we knew, which was, you know, wonderful. We spent a lot of time kind of arguing about what was the best way forward and how we could improve things. And in the end, we had a company called ThoughtWorks came in to look at our code, and part of the report that they gave said something like, they thought it might have been an intellectual experiment for someone to demonstrate how not to build a website. So at this point, it's quite good for me. So I've made this recommendation that we'll try something different. We'll try and do it differently. We'll do all the things that Di talked about, all the things that DDS talked about. Like our IT director still doesn't trust any of that. We didn't at that time have a very good relationship with GDS. It's much better now, but then it was real kind of distrust. The statistical community really doesn't like WK, so kind of talking about GDS was not necessarily a plus point. But in the end, they kind of gave me permission to run this kind of little project within the organisation, which we kind of stepped through doing all the user research and all that sort of thing that I was talking about earlier. Now, there's been a suggestion, I got a bit militant about that, in that I wouldn't speak to any of our staff about it. ONS have been so driven by just internal people who are very senior, making decisions about everything that happened on the web, that I decided we'd go as far the other way as we'd get away with. The previous website had been managed by the chief economist, so he had decided it would look good to have a big IT project on his CV, despite the fact that he'd never run any IT projects or had any idea about the web, but he felt that that was a good use of his time. So we went extreme. So we, you've got our post-it slide, it seems, in these things. But we spoke to everybody. In the end, we spoke to a couple of hundred people face-to-face or in user labs, representatives of 70 different organisations. We did things that completely terrified ONS. Kind of long-term staff, like we sponsored hack days and things like that, and we gave people our data to use and kind of encouraged people to do things that weren't really statistically legit, but just tried to get people to get involved and to give us feedback. And we got two messages essentially from everybody. Everybody hated the website. Fundamentally, we couldn't find a single person with a single nice thing to say about it. But everybody wanted help. Every single person we met, I've never met a community who was so helpful. We put out a silly, very brief kind of tree test this week. We had 500 people complete the whole thing in 45 minutes. So we were expecting to get about 100 people being open for a week. We had to close it down the same afternoon as we launched it because we had too many things to analyze. People care an enormous amount about this. So we did a load of things. We built an alpha. We built an alpha really quickly. We did it in 10 weeks. There's probably people in this building who absolutely hammered us about the technologies that we used. We just did a kind of JavaScript app to do it really fast. We used Angular. I'd never Saturday morning getting abused about technology choices, but it was at least it was slightly more lighthearted. But we did it really quickly, and our users loved it. We got absolutely fundamentally nothing but positive feedback about it. We passed our GDS assessment, we moved forward, and got asked to go forward and go with the beta. Now the problem was, the whole alpha was smoke and mirrors. Everything behind it was just basically a couple of CSV files that we mocked up. You know, it looked really nice, it was user-focused, but actually the idea of turning that into a sustainable, long-term, secure system, you know, we haven't really got there at that point, and now we've got to deliver it. The main website still falls down on a relatively regular basis. It was down for 4 hours overnight just last week, but at least it was overnight for a change. So we had to start working on the beta. So we're 6 months from the alpha. The first chunk of that, which anyone who works in government will know, I spent fighting with procurement. And then once I got through procurement, fighting with recruitment. Because you actually have to have people to do these things, and these are the two hardest things of any of these jobs. So little of my job these days is anything to do with technology or digital. It's mainly to do with recruitment and procurement. Because I can't ask anyone else to do it, because that would just be unfair. So I take that responsibility. But we've got forward and we've built a beta now, so we're going to go public on the last day of June, come what may. This is just a little kind of our publishing tool. And we've scrambled, so we haven't used GDS tools, and we also haven't used anything anything kind of standard open source. We wanted to build something that was just about what was best for ONS. At the moment, one of our what we call statistical bulletins, which is the core thing that we publish every day, takes up to 6 hours to produce. So we built a system that took that from 6 hours to 2.5 hours and just sliced it off completely. We went and did things like we integrated chart builders into it, because actually, you know, if you try to put photos on a statistical website, all you ever end up is little piles of money, little piles of coins, or really kind of obscure, like trying to be slightly twisted graphs that just annoy statisticians, because there isn't anything that's particularly attractive about doing stats. So we just do charts, we do nice D3 charts everywhere, and we built that into the system. Because the point was that we had to build something that works for our staff as well as it works for people outside. And it was one of the interesting things. So during the alpha, which I was talking about a bit earlier, that we got entirely positive feedback unless you managed to map the IP addresses back to ONS itself. And then we got pretty much continuously negative feedback because people were so annoyed that we hadn't spoken to them. So during the beta, we had to balance that out as well. But we've done a lot. So we've been working on this, and we've got this beta, and we're going to go live. It's not using Angular, which will please a lot of people. It has much tidier URLs that will please a lot of people. It makes our data, the vast majority of ONS data is open licensed anyway, and always has been. But it's just really hard to get hold of, so we're just trying to make it much more available and make it much more useful and active for people to use. So it's all going to be there, but unlike So I always think that DVLA and people cheat when they talk about their public betas, because their public betas are actually their new live services, and they're just faking it so they've got to get out of jail free corporate rules. Our beta is still an experiment. We want people to give feedback, we do want to change it, we want to bash it around. We're a long way from replacing the current site. Too many financial systems rely on it for us just to swap something over when we feel like it, so we need to be 100% sure. But yeah, so we're there. The one big thing is that one thing I've been able to achieve is I've never told anybody when I intend to launch the new site, not our national statistician, nobody. I've been able to keep it completely secret so that I'm not held by anybody to a date until I'm absolutely sure that we're right and we're ready. So this looks to the future. So obviously at some point, somewhere, we'll have a new website and that'll be cool, and hopefully Tim Harford won't hate it, because that would be a bad day. But actually at the moment, it's a bit of a clean sheet of paper. So one of my IT directors recently said that my project was like an infection at the ONS. I don't know whether he meant that positively or not. Because we've changed a lot of things, so Jenny and her team was urging, we set up a GitHub account really early on. Randomly, we just kept doing it. We just continued to publish stuff publicly, all of our code. ONS has now defaulted to that being what it does, because we've been doing it, so they didn't have really anywhere to back out of. To the extent that the GitHub account that I just set up when I was sat in Shoreditch someday waiting for my train is now the official ONS GitHub account. The blog that I set up for our sort of digital publishing blog, which still runs, it is on WordPress.com and runs off my credit card to get the ads off it and everything. It's just become the official thing for the whole digital and IT division, because they just realised it was happening, so they had to get used to it. We set up a pattern library. We paid for a pattern library as part of the alpha, because I'd read Anna Debenham's book about front-end style guides and thought it sounded really interesting, so we commissioned it. And this week, all projects that have got any kind of web front-end have been told it's now mandatory to use our front-end style guide, to use our pattern library. Now, I kind of hoped that would happen at some time in the future, but actually the fact that this is all now happening without me is great. On the bad side, I still have to go through incredible amounts of governance for everything. I still have to sit through milestone meetings and gateway meetings and all these other kinds of things to assure people that we're doing things okay. I have to do that as well as doing the GDS assessments as well. So actually, what I've ended up with is doing twice as much governance as there was before, rather than less. But the main difference is it all falls on me, so at least I can protect my developers and my designers and user researchers from having to put up with any of it. So it might crush me, but at least we're still getting things done behind me, which is kind of the role of management, I figure, anyway. It's my job to keep the crap off of my team. So that's kind of the way we work. So that's really where we are now. So, cheers. That was pretty quick. Thank you.
So what I'll probably do, we've got about 15 minutes left, and we might come down to Roger and then get this time at the end. I can ask my questions and grab an
answer. I feel your pain. I don't have a map.
That's good.
Hi everyone, I'm Roger Donald and I'm the Head of Transformation for NHS Choices, which is one of my friends said to me the other day, does that make you Head Transformer for the NHS? And can I contact you at oculusprime@nhs.net? And I thought, I don't know, maybe you can. Maybe that's the email I should be asking for. But NHS Choices is going through a massive kind of rebuild. We are currently very siloed in terms of our information. And it requires you as a patient, which all of you are, to join up the dots and figure out kind of what all the different bits of information are that you need to make decisions about your health and your social care. But first of all, NHS Choices is part of the Health and Social Care Information Centre, which is a really big organisation, spending billions of pounds and delivering lots of different services. It was formed through the Health and Social Care Act, which kind of brought a number of different bits and pieces together. You can kind of see there, but most recently NHS Direct and NHS Choices coming into the mix so that we can kind of have all the health and information data kind of stored centrally. And within HSCIC, we deliver a whole range of different products and services. We set standards and we kind of, I suppose, churn through masses and masses and masses of hospital data, GP data, and all those kinds of things. And that's really great from my team's perspective, because as we're trying to transform a digital service, understanding what users are actually doing across the NHS is one of the kind of points that actually starts to help us understand what users want and what they need. And we're going through the same mincing machine of GDS to kind of do things against user needs to ensure that kind of we're creating meaningful, useful products and services. So NHS Choices is being delivered from within HSCIC, but we also do a number of other amazing things like kind of spine, which is that's the thing that links together your personal health record and kind of figures out kind of who you are and what's wrong with you and has your health history. We do electronic prescriptions and pay GPs. We offer choose and book services, which enables you to go online and figure out what hospital you want to go and get treated in by what consultant and where. Enough about kind of what everything else within HSCIC does, more about kind of what we do at NHS Choices. Hopefully you can see from some of those figures that it's a really, really heavily used digital service. But the issue with Choices, as I've kind of pointed out already, is it's siloed. It was developed in a magazine-style format, which is great for about 6 or 7 years ago, but isn't really where we are today, moving forward. So I've got this job to transform it all, and we're tweeting about it using that hashtag, so if you're interested, you can kind of go and delve into to some of our kind of stories. But you may be familiar with the kind of GDS process of finding out if there's a problem in discovery, mocking some stuff up, as Jukesy's just kind of said about his kind of alpha and things like that, and figuring out if there's a way of solving the problem without spending loads of money and kind of baking ourselves into corners, and getting to beta to kind of trial out the tech and figure out whether or not it's actually going to work, and eventually hopefully getting to live. But what I wanted to try and do is not spend loads of money getting through kind of these first initial kind of points, because we're building things on user needs. And I suppose what I'm going to talk to you guys about is about how I've kind of tried to set up a team of people in order to develop things from a user needs perspective or a patient needs perspective, and how I'm linking that in with some of the big architectural decisions that we have to take as well, some of the big glaring issues that are staring us in the face, and about how those two kind of dichotomies of kind of, well, big architectural stuff to do, but we don't actually know what users want, so what is it that we're going to build, and how does that all work together in a harmonious way. So I've kind of borrowed from Spotify in terms of their engineering model, and very much tried to set up teams with product owners, user researchers, testers, and various other kind of roles that I'm sure you'll all be familiar with. And the idea is that as we go through each phase of delivery, whether that be through discovery and then into alpha and then into beta, the team flexes so that more and more people start off with a small core at discovery, maybe a product owner, a delivery manager and a user researcher, to actually get out there and figure out what the issues are that we need to kind of get over. And then as you understand more and get into the next phase, we can add more people into the team as early as possible, but kind of trying to make sure that the team's the right size to deliver against what we actually know. So there's the kind of teams that we've got going at the moment. Looking at conditions, looking at services, which is so hospital data, GP addresses and opening times, pharmacists, where they exist, all that kind of stuff. A condition squad, looking at kind of conditions that you can get rid of, but also conditions that you can't get rid of, so long-term conditions, chronic conditions, that kind of stuff. And importantly, this kind of bottom one, a technology enabling kind of squad, in order to counter user needs, I suppose is where I'm coming from with that, because as we go through and develop against user needs, we need to know what menu of products, tools and services we can kind of use to kind of build things out in alpha or in beta. And the mistake that I think Choice has made in the past was this kind of big upfront design problem, where we invested masses of money in things like SharePoint 2007 to kind of manage content for this magazine style run, a bit like the kind of the Times kind of digital service. And I think that's the kind of the wrong way to go. So we've started developing things in terms of an emergent design. So that's what I would refer to as just-in-time architecture. So as we understand what the need is that we need to meet, we can choose the product and service to kind of meet that need and start building iteratively in agile ways to stand that solution up. That's got some problems, but I'll come back to that in a minute. So what we're doing is we're going through this kind of build, measure, learn process where we're doing low fidelity prototyping, step-by-step user research, mapping our assumptions to a grid, and then trying to do the research that helps take those assumptions that we're certain and make a difference to what the services that we need to create for you are, and doing the research to kind of migrate those assumptions back down to being something that's actually known and quantifiable by doing the research that's relevant to that assumption. And so we've gone through iteration upon iteration of development, low fidelity wireframe prototyping, developing our personas, sticking it in front of users regularly on a weekly kind of basis in order to kind of build upon and throw away quickly things that are either kind of wrong, not working, or right, and driving us forward. And that's led us to the situation, for example, in conditions where we're dealing with things like chicken boxes, a very thin slice of part of the problem to see what is it that we should build. Where the old site is very much focused around this sort of encyclopedic description of what kind of chicken pox is. That's what it starts off with. It's kind of like chicken pox is a varicella zoster virus. And how many people actually want to kind of know that when your loved one, child, whatever, you think they've got chicken pox? So we knew that that was the wrong way to go. And so what we ended up with was go through all this prototyping to the point where we've got this three-step model that we believe we can scale out against the rest of the conditions content that we're working with. So what we learned was that when you my daughter got chickenpox whilst we were going through this process. The first thing I saw was a couple of little spots on her. She's like kind of 18 months old. So I'm like, is it chickenpox? That was the first question. I'm not sure. Is it just something else? Is it another rash? The first thing, is it chickenpox? And offering visual identities for users to be able to kind of go, okay, well, how many days in do you think it might be? It might kind of look like this. We've got skin tone selectors that are going into this as well in order to try and provide kind of more context to different demographics of the population. But then there's the kind of the second user need that we were looking at was, okay, well, if it is chickenpox, how do I treat it? And what else might I need to know? When should I get worried, and when should I contact a kind of GP or a health professional? And we figured that by kind of running this through a number of kind of tests, that actually this was a pretty good model, and we could stand this up against many, many conditions. And so we've been kind of running those through and not worrying about the technology that we build it on. As Jixi was saying earlier, you know, it's smoke and mirrors to begin with at that kind of alpha stage. We're in the same kind of situation. But there are some things that we need to try and understand. And there are some big technological kind of decisions around ontologies, around content management systems, around taxonomies, around search, where there are going to be technical spikes that we have to kind of spend time figuring out what the issue is. And that's where sort of the intentional architecture approach comes in. So we talked about having the squads that are working from user needs, but there's also this technology enabling squad working almost backwards from, okay, well, what technology might we be able to use in different phases of our development? And we're aligning the spikes and the backlog of spikes that we need to perform to the work that the other teams are doing from a user needs perspective. And the reason for that is because of this thing that I use the metaphor of the Winchester house to describe. And that's if everybody from a user needs perspective was just kind of figuring out what it was that they needed to stand up once they understood what the user need was, then we could end up with a house built in many, many different ways. So the Winchester house was, this lady was married to the guy that invented the Winchester rifle in the Wild West. Her husband died, her child died, very close to each other in terms of time. And she was left with a $20 million fortune, and she decided to just build rooms onto a four-bedroom house and just keep building and building and building and building and building as a way of coping with the stress of it all. And so what I don't want to happen, I suppose, when we rebuild and refactor NHS choices is that we're all just focused on building kind of new rooms and not actually figuring out what we're all doing across each different silo of information that we're working with at the moment. And that's why we kind of borrow from the kind of SAFE school of thought to try and make sure that the teams are finding out what the user needs are and then constraining architects that are working at a kind of enterprise level, and equally at an enterprise level the architects are constraining the teams. We're trying to have that kind of payoff, if you like, and the discussion and the various boards and governance to try and make sure that we're answering the big gnarly questions and getting things right as we progress along the delivery kind of roadmap. So where we're actually kind of ending up is in this kind of situation where it's not just about kind of user needs butting up against architectural decisions, but it's that each other's we're guiding each other so that we deliver something kind of useful. And the future direction for us is about kind of taking the silos of information that we've got today and deconstructing it all. Trying to stick things into ontologies, taxonomies and vocabularies in such a way that we can reconstruct a journey based on the things that we understand about you as an individual. Because I don't think that by rebuilding NHS choices from the ground up based on user needs is going to do enough to drive more people online and to do things digitally. When you're ill, you're still going to go and speak to your GP, consultant, surgeon, or whoever it is else that is out there in the kind of system. You're not just going to straight away go to digital, but digital can integrate with that journey. So where we're trying to head is to a situation where you visit your health professional, you have your 15-minute consultation with them or whatever else that kind of needs to be, and then via near-field communicators, via text messages, via just some sort of technology, QR codes, that kind of thing, you get the outcome of your transaction today, and we orchestrate and bring together something like an information prescription for you so that after that consultation, you can look on your phone a little bit later on about the IBS that you were kind of diagnosed with today and what you might need to do about that and whether or not you want to have some elective surgery and what groups there might be around you to help support you in that. And that means that over time, what we'd like to do is be able to kind of build up meaningful additions to that kind of tap technology where you're building your own personal profile that's appropriate for you and your needs, whereas we're equally providing a holistic digital service from a GDS type of approach where you're able to come in and get quick answers to the simple questions that you need responses to. So hopefully what we end up with is a componentized system that feeds search engines like this. This is a screenshot of Google in the USA dealing with chickenpox, where they're taking information from the equivalent of NHS Choices, the Mayo Clinic and places like that, and actually putting together things like a three-step model for you when you're searching. And so that's kind of, I suppose, quite quickly the direction of travel for us with NHS Choices, and we are hiring kind of architects and people like that. So if anybody's interested in this kind of problem, please get in touch, and I'd love to see you in one of our sites in Leeds, London, Oxford, Reading, Southampton, wherever. We're everywhere. Thanks.
Thanks so much.